As everyone knows, we've been working through a series on Genesis 1 through 11. This time, I'm planning to leave a lot more time for questions. And one of the ways that we're going to do that is I am going to leave it open for questions at various points as we hit certain issues here within the notes. If the notes look familiar, it's because you saw the same set on Sunday. And my idea here is we're setting foundations. And as we set foundations, it's important for us to come to a clear understanding of what is being said. So I'm wanting to give lots of opportunity for questions. And that's one of the reasons that we've been proceeding through things gradually and allowing time for things to sink in. I know that when I first presented the idea of Genesis 1:1 as a summary statement, it was a new concept. As we have more context, I believe that the passage starts unfolding more clearly, but I'm giving time so that we can evaluate some things. Now, you remember last time I showed you a picture of a Thanksgiving meal. Well, this time we're going to have a different use of created. Look at what RG created. This is a picture of RG Letourneau Memorial Park at Letourneau University. This is one of those places that I make visits to at least twice a year. It's a very special place. But obviously, when we use a phrase that a man created these three machines, we obviously don't mean out of nothing. He didn't just snap his fingers and behold, wow, look at that, it just came about. Our usage of the word create is a term that we can apply to humans. What happens, though, is when we look at Genesis chapter 1, we start gravitating towards the impression that it's talking about original creation. Within the scope of the argument of Genesis, that was not where Moses wanted to start. Moses did not want to start with original creation. He wanted to take time to develop something that took 7 days, or actually 6 days, to accomplish. Because God was using the seventh day memorial as an indicator for the nation Israel that God was as responsible for the creation of the nation Israel as he was for putting mankind in a restored universe. Therefore, Moses wanted to start. God wanted Moses to start with the restoration of the universe. Now, we need to think about an overview of the book of Genesis. So let's go ahead and do this. Now, we've introduced some hand signals. We'll gradually be working our way so we can understand more of the content of the book of Genesis from them. But Genesis chapters 1 and 2 deals with creation. And when we say creation, we mean his restoration of the universe to make it habitable for mankind. What happened in the next chapter? What happened in chapter 3? The fall. Adam and Eve partook of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. Now that's not talking about ethical good and ethical evil. Not talking about sin. It's not talking about anything related to that. What it's talking about is what had they experienced in the garden? God's goodness. They experienced God's blessing. But what happened when they fell? What happened when they plunged themselves into death? They started to experience God's cursing. And we have seen that the book of Genesis is dealing consistently with the theme that God creates what is good. God is out to bless. And what happens when man gets involved? man turns God's blessing into cursing. And consistently, as we look at the book of Genesis, we see that there's a downward cycle that spirals downward whenever man becomes involved. Here we are, third chapter of the Bible, and man who has been put into a perfect environment is all of a sudden under God's curse with death. Well, you'd think that's about as bad as it can get. But in Genesis chapter 4, Cain murders Abel. Okay, chapters 5 and 10, we have some good news. We have some genealogies. But, you know, why do you have a genealogy? Someone was born, they had children, and they died. And we keep going through a cycle, and it's a cycle that has death involved. So chapters 5 and 10 are genealogies. And then chapters 6 through 8, we have the flood. You know, the rains came down and the floods came up. Okay, we know all about that. And in Genesis chapter 9, God had a peace treaty, the rainbow. And so he made a peace treaty and set his bow up on the wall, said, okay, I've got a peace treaty and the world is never going to suffer a universal flood ever again. Whoops, let's see, what was chapter 10? Genealogies, very good. And then we hit chapter 11, Tower of Babel. Okay, then in chapter 12 through 25, we have Abraham. Now, let me tell you something about Abraham. Abraham had two kids, I. First one was named Ishmael, and the second one was named Isaac. And so, lo and behold, you look at You look at Isaac in chapter 26, and there's a focus upon him. Now, Isaac had two sons also. First son, they were twins, but the first one born was Esau, and then there was Jacob. Jacob is going to receive a great deal of focus here within the book, chapters 27 through 36. Jacob had a big family. He had 12 boys and one daughter. Daughter's name was Dinah. Who's in the kitchen with Dinah? And one of those sons, one of the 12 sons, was Joseph, and Joseph receives attention from Genesis chapter 37 through 50. So let's see if we can do this. Okay, generations. Okay, genealogies. Then we have
blood.
And then we have and then we're back to 10 genealogies. And then 12 through 25 is Abraham. And then 26 is Isaac. And then 27 through 36 is Jacob. And 37 through 50, Joseph. Okay, that's a quick overview of the book. As we look at a little more detail, Moses tells us the structure of his outline. Each of the sections of the book of Genesis, if the introductory statement were translated literally, would say, these are the generations of. One exception, and that is that the summary statement for the first section is Genesis 1:1. In the beginning God created, or restored, the heavens and the earth. And so then, within each of these sections, after we have an introductory statement, then we look at what became of it. What happened? And so we have creation. And creation starts out just great. Because God took that which had been cursed, that which had a problem. Remember how the earth was without form and void, and what did God do? In 6 days, he took care of the problem. The first 3 days, he took care of formlessness, and the second 3 days, he took care of voidness, and then he was tired. He rested because he was done, not because he was tired. He had accomplished what needed to be done. But then, lo and behold, we start out with Then another summary statement. Genesis chapter 2, verse 4. And what Moses does for us is he starts us not at the same beginning. He doesn't back us up to day one, but he looks again at day number 6. In Genesis chapter 2, 4, through the end of the chapter, is focusing on the sixth day. He goes into much more detail than he did in the first discussion of it. But then things go downhill, because in this Toledot, we have the fall, and then Cain murders Abel. Notice how things started out very good. Beginning of the sixth day, and it proceeds down and down. And within Genesis, that's a major focus. And so the summary statements here are the way that Moses tells us how to look at this book. As we look at each of these sections, we see God's blessing turn into cursing. Do you see why I look at the tree of the knowledge of good and evil from the perspective of the tree of the knowledge of blessing versus cursing? That is what is going to be presented over and over and over and over again in this book. God starts in, and man finds out over the course of the book of Genesis, time and time again, that God is the deliverer. God is the one who works on the basis of grace. God is the restorer. But man is the one who introduces problems, time and time again. Okay, does it make sense, the flow of thought here within Genesis around these toledot, these sections? These are the generations of, and how it is that the cursing versus blessing theme receives attention throughout the book of Genesis. In other words, we're not looking at a book that just says, well, this happened, and this happened, and next this, and then this, and then this, and we're there left to wonder, well, how do we make sense of it? Moses has done that for us. Now, why would Moses do that? Why would he give us a book that is so organized? Well, let's think. When was it that I've argued that this book was written? Yeah, it's great. 1446 is the year of the Exodus. That's the year of the parting of the Red Sea. And it's going to be relatively soon after that. You know, we can't pinpoint an exact date. But the book was written there as the nation is ready to receive the law. But what happened before that? You remember how Moses needed to go and God told him, I want you to gather together a group of people and I want you to tell them something. So he gathered together a group of people and he told them. What was it that God kept saying he wanted to make sure that Moses would communicate to which groups of people? The elders of Israel and Pharaoh. We're supposed to be told that I am, is their God. The Lord, the one who makes covenants, the one who makes promises and keeps those promises to bless, that God would not allow Pharaoh, he would not allow anything to stand in the way of him keeping the promises that he had made to Abraham, to Isaac, to Jacob. Moses is needing to tell the people of Israel that they can trust God. God is truly in charge of things, and he's going to keep his promises. This book is arranged in such a way that the people could see that they would need a God like that to keep the promises that he had made. That was the only way that they would receive deliverance from Egypt, and the only way that they would be delivered into the promised land in the way that God had promised. The book of Genesis is the case that Moses has made in regard to God, in regard to the nation, and telling them about their response that they needed to have towards God. Now, one thing that we may not be familiar with in the book of Genesis, but I'd like to say that it's a much more prominent theme than we tend to think of it as. The book of Genesis emphasizes that God, who keeps promises, expects to be believed by his people. Let's take a look at Genesis chapter 4, verse 1, just to introduce this concept a little bit. Now Adam knew Eve, his wife, and she conceived and bore Cain, which means acquire, and said, I have acquired a man, the Lord. Now, our translations don't quite read that way. And the reason that they don't read that way is because there are two words in Hebrew that look very, very, very similar. In fact, under certain circumstances, they can look identical. It's the words et and et. And lo and behold, there's one word et that means with, and there's another word et that means that what is following is a definite direct object. It's not an indefinite or qualitative direct object, it is a definite one. Our translations have operated under the assumption that this is the word that means with. And so it often is rendered, I have obtained a man with the help of the Lord. And so they have with, and they kind of amplify it. But there's a huge problem with that word being translated as with. The first problem is that it's the wrong kind of with. It's a with of accompaniment. And that doesn't work here. And the second problem is that within the same structure, et is used in another way and is understood properly by our translations as saying that there's a definite direct object. The better way of handling this is, I have acquired a man-child, or I have acquired a man, the Lord. Eve thought that this was the seed of woman who was going to destroy the serpent. Now, Cain wasn't the seed of woman who would destroy the serpent. But notice what it tells us about her understanding as the woman, as Eve, heard what was told to the serpent. Notice Genesis 3:15. I will put enmity between you and the woman, and between your seed and her seed. Her seed is a reference to Jesus Christ. He shall bruise your head, and you shall bruise his heel. And she says, that's true. And then she's saying, oh, my firstborn child. This is the fulfillment of the promise. Now, we can't fault her for wanting her firstborn son to be the one who would fulfill the promise. But notice how it tells us what she understood as God spoke to the serpent. Notice how much that tells us about her faith, about what she believed. And then, of course, we're also familiar with Abraham. Genesis 15:6. Abraham believed the Lord, and it was accounted to him for righteousness. In the book of Genesis, the concept of a faith response to God, of believing him for his promises, is one that receives attention through the book. Moses is preparing the people. And he is preparing them by showing them a divine outline of their history. And he does that through the Toledot. Okay, what I would like to do is take a look at the overview of Genesis 1:1 through 2:3. But are there questions thus far in what we have covered? Are there any points that we could clarify? Yes. When we, on Sunday, talk about Genesis 3, that topic will be coming up. And that's so, yes, we'll be talking about what it is that Adam and Eve had as opposed to what they didn't have. Now, what I will give a basic overview of what I would understand here on this. Remember, there were two trees placed in the garden that there were special instructions regarding. They were told you could eat of any of the trees, and then there was one tree that there was a prohibition. The tree of life, though, is a tree that we don't have any specific commands given in Scripture concerning it. In other words, the account of Genesis does not specifically make a command related to it, but that tree is singled out. Now, at the same time, when we look at the death that Adam and Eve suffered, when dying, they died. Immediately, their fellowship, their relationship with God was severed. We do receive commentary by other scriptures that help us to understand that all of humanity was then plunged into death. And we also understand that all of humanity is plunged into the potential of having their death become permanent if it is not reversed by believing in Jesus Christ and his provision of life. Now we notice something very interesting that we'll spend time discussing. Okay, the Toledot, okay, where we have the... This is what became of the generations of, or the descendants of this person or that person. It's kind of showing us that within that section, God's blessing or God's cursing or the mixture between what has happened. In other words, we're seeing, okay, for example, in the first section, we see how a formless and void universe was restored. Okay, that's turning cursing into blessing. Then what we have is the sixth day is where the next Toledot starts. It starts with blessing, but God's creation is not yet complete. We don't yet have certain things happening. There's no man to till the garden. There are certain things that are said not yet to be complete. But God then completes it, bringing us to the point of the creation of the woman, that now it's no longer some bad, but it's very good as there's man and woman. But then we go immediately into the fall, and we immediately after that go into Cain murders Abel, and then that Toledot ends. So how does that second Toledot go? God's blessing goes into cursing with the fall, and it further goes into cursing with Cain murdering Abel. So this is what became out of day six. Blessing turned into cursing, and it got even worse. And so that's where, within those sections, we see the process of things going downhill. Each one of those cycles goes like this. Okay, now returning to the concept of the tree of life. After Adam and Eve had sinned, but before they believed, before they believed the promise, before they came to understand anything about the promise that was made by God, we notice what God says, starting in verse 22 of Genesis 3. Then the Lord God said, "Behold, the man has become like one of us, knowing good and evil. He knows both blessing and cursing." God had always known that. After all, you start thinking back to the fall of Satan, and it's very evident that cursing has been around for a period of time. "And now, lest he put out his hand and take also of the tree of life and live forever. So therefore, man is kicked out of the garden." Not that God doesn't want them to live forever. That's not it at all. He wants them to live forever. But now the provision through which life is to be received is through the provision of Christ. In other words, once sin and death has entered into the human race, God needs to follow the plan that we see being followed throughout the Bible to bring about the solution God wants. It was not, "Okay, you've eaten of this tree, now you can correct it by going and eating of that tree." It was instead, "Okay, you ate of this tree, that means I have to institute a program which takes a whole Bible to explain in order to bring about the long-term solution." So, what can we say from that? We can say that Adam and Eve, before the fall, did not possess guaranteed life. If they had eternal life, if they had life that was guaranteed forever, to always be in God's presence, do you see the problem? Then it wouldn't be eternal if it could be taken away. Their situation was one where they did not possess life guaranteed forever in the presence of God before the fall. They did not possess that. They fell. They fell into death. And what God said was, "Okay, now it's time to move them out of the garden, not allow them to have access to the tree of life, and there will be a specific provision which is going to be pointing forward to the seed of woman who would take care of the problem." In other words, God's not interested in just covering over death. God wants a permanent solution. So once the fall happened, it was necessary for God to make the plans to send Christ as the provision for life. What we have argued is that in Genesis chapter 4, verse 1, Moses tells us very clearly that the woman believed promise.
From the tree they couldn't go?
Yeah. They were in a situation where there was no guarantee given as to which way things would go. They didn't. They must have looked at it and said, "This tree doesn't look as good as some of the other trees." Have no idea, but they were in the grocery store and they were picking the wrong brands. So what I would say is, in the garden, before the fall, all bets were off as to which way things would go. Obviously, God knows what way things are going to go. But as Adam and Eve were facing life, it was God told us something really bad is going to happen if we eat of this tree. He's told us we're free to eat of all the trees. And I imagine it'll be very interesting when they give us their testimony as to why they weren't interested in the tree of life. But for some reason, they didn't seem to be interested in it. Yeah, I would take it, yes. When you think about it, Adam and Eve only knew blessing. And so when they ate of it, they have now known, whoops, we had blessing, and now they know cursing. They're able to make the comparison. And I don't think it took them very long to figure out after God made the pronouncements in chapter 3. Kind of looks like God's got the better plan rather than the serpent. It didn't take them long to figure out, we better really listen to what God has to say this time. He's got the solution. I think that their experience with evil, with cursing, made them very ripe to hear the message that God gave them. I mean, how often do we think in our own lives or in the lives of our kids, you know, something really bad happens and then all of a sudden, oh, we really learned the lesson. I think that's what happened with Adam and Eve. I think that's what happened. Oh, George. I don't think so. Because notice how it is treated that in Genesis 3:22, God is saying, if they eat of that tree, I'm going to have to keep my promise to them. So the tree of life is not going to turn into a tree of cursing. It's going to be a tree of blessing. But that's not the right way. That's not the best way for the problem to be resolved. And that's why we have the rest of the Bible preparing for Jesus Christ to meet the needs that mankind had, that he can be restored to life, that sin and its penalty can be taken care of, that man can have fellowship with God, that God can clean the universe and remove the taint of sin out of it, and accomplish with man what was designed in the garden. So, the one solution would have God as the justifier, but not just. Romans chapter 3 tells us that God set about the plan that he had for taking care of man's problems that would be set forth in such a way that he would be both just and justifier. He needs to be fair, but he needs to make it so that man, when God is fair, is able to be a beneficiary of God's grace. God's grace is not ignoring his justice. But if God were in a position to have to keep this promise without resolving the sin problem, it would create a difficulty. God didn't allow that to happen. I don't see that it would. And yeah, there would still be unresolved issues. Okay. What we see here, it's important here to note that a lot of people end up portraying the tree of knowledge, I mean the tree of life, as becoming a curse under the hypothetical. And I don't see God as setting it forth as having that potential. Tree of life is always a tree of blessing. Now, let's carry that out a little further. The book of Revelation puts forth a reward, as a reward for those believers who are overcomers to be able to partake of that tree. Now, all believers, whether they are overcomers or not, possess life. But the overcomers will be the people who possess life the most, in its most abundant form, and it will be a very high reward. Okay, so that allowed us to take an overview of the Toledot. Yes.
More abundant?
I believe so.
Very good.
Yeah, I think it's both parts. And I do find it most appropriate that the last book of the Bible, now for me it's not last by as many years as some people would have it be last by, but the last book of the Bible, written a couple of years after some of the other books, several years after, culminates with a larger treatment of the Tree of Life as one that also brings reward to the overcomer. So, man wasn't very interested in it, but God hasn't lost interest in the Tree of Life. Yes, absolutely. Yeah, the fact that they had known God's blessing, they were experiencing His cursing, whereas if they had eaten of the Tree of Life, they would have been guaranteed God's blessing forever. I think so. Well, you remember the woman said that she saw that it was good to the eyes and to eat. So, yes, there it's very much concerned about literal eating. Okay, let's now take a look at creation itself and the overview of it. As we indicated, we have not advocated the traditional gap theory. But if you look at this model, which we reject, Genesis 1:1 would be talking about original creation. Verse 2 would be talking in Genesis 1 about the earth being formless and void. And then we look at days 1 through 6, and it would be the restoration. The only thing that is incorrect about this is that 1:1 has nothing to do with original creation, and Genesis doesn't mention original creation. Let me ask a question. How many times in this sermon, other than this one time now, have I mentioned the word Trinity? Zero times. The fact that I didn't mention it, does that mean I don't believe in the Trinity? No. Okay. Moses, I would say, didn't mention original creation here in Genesis 1. Is that a proof that he didn't believe in it? No. It is instead that it was not something that contributed to the argument that God had given for him to make. So, here's how the summary statement view goes. Like all of those Toledot statements, you have an introductory statement at the beginning. And then we have a development. And so, original creation under this view is not mentioned at all. So the blue box that you see off on the left-hand side where it says original creation, Genesis doesn't talk about that. Where Genesis starts is by saying, okay, here's an overview of what happened in the 6 days. That is, what happened in the 6 days? God created the heavens and the earth. Why did he do that? It's because of 1:2. Why is it that God restored the universe? Because the universe had become formless and void. The first 3 days were devoted to dealing with the problem of formlessness. So days 1 through 3 have to deal with formation. And days 4 through 6 deal with filling the earth. Day 7 is a rest. Not because God is tired, but because he had completed what he had set out to do. Okay, it's the focus is on heavens in relation to the earth, so I'm not sure how extensive or how far out to take the statement, but I would say I conceive of at least the solar system being involved. I don't know how far to take the restoration, as far as geographically how expensive the restoration was. And the thing that I would have to say about that is I don't have any passage that tells me where the angels resided or that the angels even resided on planet Earth before that. So, in other words, it's something Scripture doesn't really tell us, one way or the other. Do you see what in other words, right, Moses doesn't tell us. There are a few passages in the Bible that allude to some sort of a conflict, but it's sketchy. It's really sketchy. I have them. Yeah, there are a couple of passages in Isaiah and that make allusion to it, but I don't have those notes on those particular passages. So, for the purposes of Moses' readers, we have to think about what kinds of problems did Moses' readers have. Well, when we think about why was it that God ended up sending the Israelites into Egypt? Well, the problem that was developing during that last section of Genesis, Genesis chapters 37, following that section in there, we start finding out that the brothers of Joseph were very, very, very friendly with Canaanites. And all sorts of the Canaanite thinking was starting to work its way into the thoughts of the brothers as they had closer and closer relations with all of the Canaanites. And when I use the word relations, I'm talking in all senses. Okay, they were getting closer and closer to these people, and guess who was getting influenced by whom? So guess what God did? God said, time to bring you into Egypt. Now, there are a couple of really funny statements that happen in the book of Genesis. Did Joseph want for Jacob and his brothers to be welcomed by Pharaoh? Or did he not like his brothers and not like his father? Okay, he loved them, right? So why is it that on two occasions Joseph says, now when he asks you what your job is, tell them that you are sheep herders. And then it mentions immediately afterwards something that Moses tells us, because Egyptians detested sheep herders. They say, does Joseph like his father and his brothers? Why is he telling them this? Well, the Egyptians were very nervous about people starting to form alliances and conspiracies against them. So it was Pharaoh's thinking, oh, they're sheep herders. No one's going to like them. These are wonderful people to let into my country. Notice God's sense of humor. They were getting too friendly with the Canaanites, so what does God do? He has Jacob make sure to tell Pharaoh, we're people that the Egyptians won't really like. Before that, we're told that Abraham was an idolater as he was in Ur of the Chaldees. And when we think about Moses had a lot of exposure being in the household of Pharaoh's daughter to all the Egyptian religion, and we're told that he was trained up in all of their sciences and all of their religion. What do we have going on? The Israelites are people who were being affected by Babylonian thought, Canaanite thought, Egyptian thought. And Moses is writing to them to help straighten them out. They had gotten themselves entangled in a lot of false teaching. There's much that is needing to be corrected by the book of Genesis. And so as Moses is writing, remember we're talking about how he's trying to draw them to belief in the Lord, and he's trying to push them away from the false religions that to various extents they had bought into. And by the time the Exodus is happening, the Israelites were about as far away from God as they could possibly be. You look at Moses when God met him, and you look at Moses and you say, yeah, he's really not doing too good. He's got a few problems. Remember how he gets around and he starts killing people and he starts doing a lot of things, and he doesn't really understand that God can do what God says he can do. So what does he say? Oh, I can't speak. Remember all the objections that Moses gave? These were not people who were thinking about things from God's standpoint. There's a lot of correction that's needing to go on here in the book of Genesis. What Moses does in the creation account is he shows them that God is truly in charge of things. God is the one who did things right as he prepared the universe for mankind, and he shows them through the Toledot, through the generation statements, through the outline of Genesis, that once we get to Abraham, the level of blessing starts to go up. When you look at Genesis chapters 1 through 11, and you look at what's happening before God called Abraham, and before God is making specific plans that are going to be accomplished through his lineage, the downhill pattern is a very steep downhill pattern. But on the other hand, when you look at Abraham, you look at Isaac, you look at Jacob and Joseph, yeah, we see some problems. But it's not that quick plunge, because they are seeing the promises of God and they are believing them. And that has an impact upon them. And that's very much in the background of what Moses is doing here as he is writing this book. Okay, other questions? Okay, I hold to a very early date of the book of John as well. Oh, yes, absolutely. John 5:2 requires it to be earlier than 70, but there's no reason that John didn't write really rather soon. I mean, there's nothing that requires it at all. Nothing requires a late date. And in fact, as I look at the Gospel of John, how many Gentiles did Jesus minister to in the book of John? Pilate is it.
Gentiles came. And
they weren't Gentiles. They were Hellenist Jews. The reason that I would say that is because Jesus treated it as a... He said that... I think that he was seeing it as a fulfillment of Deuteronomy 30. Because diaspora Jews were coming to him, and he said it's now time for the Son of Man or Son of God to be glorified. He's taking it as a fulfillment of Deuteronomy 30. So although they're called Greeks, okay, let's turn there so that everyone isn't wondering what's being discussed. John chapter 12, verse 20. Now there were also certain Greeks among those who came to worship at the feast. The term Greeks is used either of people because of their ethnicity or because of their custom. And I would take that these are ones because of custom who were foreigners. That is, they weren't born in Israel, but they're coming to the feast. That makes them either proselytes or Hellenized Jews. In either event, they're going to be regarded as Jews. Then they came to Philip. So they came to a Greek named disciple who was from Bethsaida of Galilee and asked him, saying, "Sir, we wish to see Jesus." Philip came and told Andrew, and in turn Andrew and Philip told Jesus. But Jesus answered them, saying, "The hour has come that the Son of Man should be glorified." Deuteronomy chapter 30 says that when God has scattered the Israelites into all these foreign nations, and they turn to the Lord, that that's the time when the Lord is going to get ready to give them their king. And he says, oh, this is significant. Now, it didn't turn out that that was going to be the right time for that, but things were poised that in many ways it was entirely appropriate for Jesus to take it as a significant statement. Steve, you had raised another passage, and he was very much focused upon what is necessary for a person to receive life. That was one aspect of Jesus' main message. Jesus had a message of how the nation would be prepared to receive its Messiah and how individuals would receive life. John focuses on how individuals receive life without entangling it with other issues. How to receive life, how to have it more abundantly. And so very interesting thing that developed within Israel. There were warnings in the Old Testament about welcoming false messiahs. And what happened was the religious leaders became so stringent about trying to avoid accepting a false messiah that they made the rules so tough that even the true one couldn't pass. Now, sometimes parents are guilty of that. Have you ever heard of a little kid in a shopping center who's running away from everyone, including the uniformed security guards, because they've been told to stay away from strangers? And the parents didn't say, but in a circumstance where you get separated from everyone, someone who's in a uniform will be able to help you? Well, essentially what happened was the religious leaders in Israel said, there's going to be a false messiah, so let's make sure that we don't accept one of those. They went against everyone. And John is making it clear within a nation where, you remember what happened when the wise men came and they were able to say, well, where could we find the Messiah? Oh, well, he's supposed to be there in Bethlehem. And, you know, this is about the right time, but how many people out of the religious establishment went there to Bethlehem to figure out what's the star doing there? The real blind spot in Israel was that, as Jesus said it, he was sent by the Father, and the people wouldn't accept him, but if someone came in his own name, they would. They were very much geared against believing the Messiah. And John catalogs how Jesus overproved that he was the one qualified as Messiah and giver of life. Despite the fact that, as he summarizes in John chapter 1, verse 11, what was the national reception of Jesus? They rejected him. He came to his own, and his own received him not. But despite that, he did not wipe his hands of them and say, well, forget this. He still, as John 1:12, as many, even with a nation that overwhelmingly rejected him, as many as received him, how did they receive him? By believing in him. He gave the right to become children of God. That is, to those who believe on his name. And so what we have in John is very much a blind spot also. that he's dealing with. He's cataloging it over and over again about how, despite the proofs that Jesus gave for himself and his message, he was overwhelmingly rejected, although he gave far more proof than was necessary to validate who he was and what he promised.